Today's conversation is with Naomi Bailey Cooper, a fashion textiles designer, artist, and researcher, exploring the values that could shape ethical and long-lasting fashion. Her work places an emphasis on the sensory tactility, layering, and aesthetic thick richness of materials. Recently, her focus has been developing fashion and textile artifacts, delivering talks and facilitating workshops which examine approaches that can be applied to create alternatives to animal materials. Naomi received a funding award from the Victoria and Albert Museum and the London College of Fashion for her PhD by practice, where she pioneered embellishment alternatives to fur and exotic animal materials. These novel embellishment prototypes manipulated unconventional natural materials as an alternative to some of the appeals of fur and exotic animal materials. During this period of research, Naomi exhibited her practice internationally at the Fashion from Nature exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, as well as the Natural History Museum of Denmark, the Design Research for Change London Design Festival, and Transfashional Museo della Città di Mini in Italy. Naomi's research and practice sits within the new paradigm of design that we are exploring here on this podcast, as well as through Sustainability 5.0. And it was incredibly inspiring to have this conversation today with her. Yeah. And I learned a whole lot, and I hope you will enjoy too.
Spirit of Design delves deep into the unseen elements of design and holistic sustainability.
Join us, Amy and
Anya,
for open conversations with creatives, scholars, activists, and others to envision alternative design futures that are diverse, inclusive, community-centric, and in symbiosis with all life on this planet.
So much for joining me today for this chat. I've been looking forward to this for a little while. I know when we first connected, Amy and I both have been following your work for the past, it's been like a year, I think, and really interested in these new paradigms that you're bringing in, particularly in regards to textiles and fashion. So I'm so happy to have you here today.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, me too. I'm really excited about doing this, and I'm so happy that you reached out and that we've connected and everything, and excited for our chat.
Amazing. And how are you doing in this time?
Well, I think for like a lot of other creatives, it's a real time for reflection and thinking more deeply about my work and how it can maybe be pivoted a little bit. It's a tricky time, really. I think it's a lot of other people, I've had some work cancelled and postponed, so I'm really reflecting now on how I can maybe adjust some of the work I've been doing, so it can either be made digital or it can maybe connect more deeply with people. I think in terms of animal materials, which is really what I've been focusing on for the last few years, I think a lot of people are being forced, going out into nature a lot more, and through walking in parks and just sort of having to step outside their front door to get some fresh air. And I'm just hoping some of these things are going to help connect people a little bit more with nature, and that they'll see animals and they'll see more birds coming into their garden and parks, and they'll just connect a little bit more and stop and pause and reflect a little bit more deeply.
I hope so too, and I'd love to expand on that a little bit more, but perhaps you could give
the listeners a little bit of an introduction to yourself and how you got to where you are today and what your research and current practice revolves around?
Yeah, sure. So I originally studied fashion design, studied fashion design women's wear at St. Martin's, graduated in 2012. I think like a lot of other people, I was really attracted to studying fashion because it was very creative and it seemed really exciting. And I loved being around loads of other really creative people at St. Martin's. And that was really cool and really great. But at the time, I also was becoming more and more aware of sustainability and the environment, and how especially the fashion textiles industry was not, you know, contributing to polluting the environment. I guess in terms of sustainability, for me, it all started when I did this summer school in, I think it was my second year of studying, and I did a summer school in Copenhagen in innovating sustainable fashion. And it really kind of opened my eyes to all these other possibilities that I could be exploring as a creative practitioner, and, you know, different materials, understanding supply chains, just new ways of working, really. And I came back and I sort of put that into my graduate collection. So I started using dead stock materials, and I started really thinking about where those materials were coming from and what they were made of, and their composition. And, you know, definitely animal materials and respect and care for animals has always been really pertinent for me. So I was a big lover of silk. I used to use silk a lot in my work. So I looked into silk production, and I tried to find if there was a more ethical alternative to silk. Because the way that silk is manufactured is that the silkworms are effectively gassed, and then the silk thread is wound off the cocoon. But with something called Ahimsa silk or peace silk, the silkworm breaks out of the cocoon naturally. And so I started sourcing Ahimsa silk, or peace silk as it's sometimes called, and a lot of it was very slubby, so the material, a lot of the quality wasn't the same. But I just sort of kept going, kept sourcing, kept trying to find the nicest quality I could find. And I played around a lot with peace silk, and I looked at things like zero waste pattern cutting, and I kind of looked at also embellishment, and whether embellishment, so not only the base material, but whether embellishment could be a bit more sustainable. And that led me to then looking at growing my own embellishments. As you're probably aware, you know, lots of embellishments on the market are sort of synthetic, so sort of synthetic beads and synthetic sequins, and a lot of that stuff was going straight into landfill at the end of use. And it was just really kind of an exploration, I suppose, for me into what kind of alternatives were out there and what I could do with alternatives and how I could play with them. And it wasn't, I suppose, necessarily saying that something was right or wrong, but it's just exploring more options. And it then led me to present the collection where I'd grown crystal embellishments on fabric, just as a sort of a suggestion, really, into, you know, in terms of biodegradability and life cycle. And so I was experimenting with that, playing around with that a little bit, and I kind of came out of my fashion degree and thought, well, I don't really want a regular design job, and I just didn't feel like I fitted in the industry either, really. So I looked at alternative sort of career paths, but I still wanted to be really creative, and I think I was a real thinker as well. I loved research. And then this really great job came up, which was with the Design Against Crime Research Centre at St. Martin's. Mm-hmm. And they were doing a project with Gucci. And that was about exploring alternatives, alternative materials, but also alternative methods to try and discourage counterfeit products being developed. Basically, they were exploring whether Gucci could come up with some really interesting materials or techniques to try and discourage brands to copy their products and discourage consumers from buying counterfeit products as well. So a lot of my job was physical groundwork. So I was out looking at lots of clothes and shops and trying to look at things that are maybe a little bit too similar to Gucci, and then feeding that back to Gucci and a lawyer. So a lot of it was very sort of practical in terms of research, a lot of quantitative research as well, so a lot of data collection. But then it was really interesting because it also lent that design arm. So a lot of it, like I say, was about materials, but it was also about tech devices. But I just really enjoyed the research element of it as well. It involved stepping back a little bit and sort of considering different types of idea generation and design generation, I think, for, you know, a huge brand like Gucci. And it just felt like that was such a cool opportunity. And then shortly after that, I then worked for Burberry. Similarly, I came in as a researcher. That's this time I was sort of in-house. And I worked on a unique supply chain project for them. So I was looking at the supply chain of their three main fiber categories. So that was cotton, cashmere, and merino wool. And I was looking at, again, it was about alternatives. Can there be alternatives to those key materials that we're sourcing, and what do those alternatives need to be? And that was really great because I got to bring in lots of different teams at Burberry. So I was basically working across design, procurement, corporate social responsibility, fabric engineering. I was also involved in some of the manufacturing side. So that was really exciting. And it was during that time that I sort of had this idea that, you know, okay, research seems to really suit me. I really enjoy doing that. I really enjoy that sort of stepping back and really thinking and really considering. But at the same time, a lot of that research that I was doing both at Burberry and Gucci was very desk-based, and it didn't have such a physical making element. So I thought, well, is there a way I can combine those two things? And I started looking into PhD research, and especially practice-based PhD research, so I could actually go back and really explore the embellishment again and the sort of decorative element of fashion through making, but also entwine research. And also whilst I was at Burberry, I noticed that at the time they were using fur and exotic animal materials. And I kind of, you know, spoke to different people there, and I was really interested in the opinions as to why they were using those materials. And there's a sort of, you know, synthetics versus natural materials debate very much going on there. So they weren't using very many synthetic alternatives to fur because they felt it was unsustainable, but also that it didn't have the right qualities that fur and exotics had. And whilst I was at Burberry, I also tried to start sourcing vegan alternatives to leather that weren't synthetic, and presenting that to different design teams and sort of, you know, having discussions around those qualities and whether what qualities they would need to have and whether they could be implemented. And I just knew that it was a much bigger conversation, essentially. And I knew that I needed to, you know, I've been in this really unique positions, really, at these two companies where I was the only, you know, at Burberry, I was the only person doing research. I was this sort of oddball kind of person doing this one-off project. I just wanted to keep going, working in that fashion. And so I thought that the PhD was perfect to just explore it a little bit more deeply. And I'd had lots of my own ideas, and I wanted to bring in some of ideas for my graduate collection as well. So I came to London College of Fashion and applied for a PhD and basically put together a proposal which was to explore whether embellishment could offer an alternative to fur and exotics. So I'd noticed that fur and exotic animal materials are being used mostly as decoration in fashion. So it's less that people were wearing a full fur coat, but it's more that people were wearing maybe sort of, you know, smaller fur accents on clothing, and designers were manipulating fur and exotics really, you know, a lot. It wasn't so, it seems like they were being used as embellishment anyway. So I thought, well, could they, you know, what would happen if an alternative material was used in their place? You know, would it, what would be lost, what would be gained? And that was essentially my research topic, was to explore through my own making whether embellishment could offer an alternative and what values it would need to have. Then I was also working a lot with industry. So I did interviews and workshops with industry to try and find out what the appeals of fur and exotics were and whether those appeals could be applied as a design brief for me to develop alternatives. I was also really lucky that I was able to work with the Victoria and Albert Museum as well. So I was sort of exploring all these really cool artifacts in their archives that, you know, contained fur and exotic trims and embroidery and embellishments. So it was really, the PhD was great. The PhD was 4 years of just me focusing very deeply on a subject and being able to use research and also use my own practice and explore through making. And it's such a hands-on subject anyway, something like that, especially with fur and, you know, fur feathers and exotic reptile skins, very tactile. So I definitely needed that.
Thank you for sharing all that with us. And wow, you've been on quite an interesting journey. And I'd love to ask you if perhaps you could share with us in more detail what you actually uncovered and explored within your PhD research. I think it might be interesting to know what you found out in regards to why there is this huge appeal towards still real fur, feathers, reptile skins, and other exotic animal materials.
Yeah, sure. So it was really fascinating. So my focus was very much why I wanted to talk to designers and people working in the fashion industry who love fur and exotics and who would use them in their work. So I specifically targeted companies that I knew were using a lot of fur and exotics. And it was just very interesting for me, someone who doesn't use those materials, so doesn't necessarily understand the appeals, to really find out what they were. But I mean, overall, some of the big things that came out was, one of them was connection to nature, which was really fascinating. So, and even some of the people that I interviewed, they even admitted that using fur and exotic animal materials connected them to nature, even if it was in a somewhat paradoxical way. So it was just the fact that this material, that they, I think that it aesthetically, they could see the provenance of the material. That was a real appeal. You know, you could see that something with fur, you know, can see which animal that has come from. With reptile skins, they can see which animal that's come from, and feathers. Similarly, you know, even if those animals, as I say, paradoxically, are coming from farms and they're not really coming from nature per se. So that was very interesting. And then that, and then also another appeal that really came out was rarity. So this idea of these materials were, had connotations of rare, and even, you know, hides and skins would have little markings, unique markings for the individual animal. That was one of the reasons, for example, that a lot of designers didn't like using fake fur, because it was produced on a continuous manufacturing process, so it didn't have those unique markings, it didn't have those kind of inimitable and unusual little details that they really liked, and that was what was really appealing. So they didn't want something that was homogenous, they wanted something that was you know, each piece is unique from the last, and that again connects them so much to nature. And another thing that came up a lot was craftsmanship, so the associated craftsmanship with using those materials, that they're quite tricky to use sometimes, and it's this idea of craftsmanship and heritage and the specific techniques that are associated with using them, especially in embellishment. And there's a lot about material manipulation, and also the craftsmanship to make them even more rare as well. So a lot of it was how designers were manipulating fur and exotics to make them feel even more rare than what they were, because a lot of designers now, I mean, they're using key fur and exotics, which I would say would be mink, python, and ostrich feathers. Those are some of the most commonly used materials. You know, how can designers, especially at the high end, make those materials different from the next designer who's using them? So to try and maintain feelings of rarity. So that was very interesting, the way that connection to nature, rarity, and craftsmanship were all really linked with each other. And then, of course, there are other appeals, which were the tactile quality that animal materials have, the lightweight volume that they have. So those were other two kind of more the tactile and aesthetic appeals that they had. And again, linking, you know, with something like lightweight volume, it linked again to craftsmanship and how designers were manipulating fur to make it as light as possible. So not a lot of my research fur was being used just as much on spring summer collections as it was in autumn winter collections.
Wow.
Yeah. So
wow.
That always surprises people, but
wow.
I think that, yeah, I guess a lot of people still think that, you know, fur in particular is associated with warmth and insulation. Mm. And that wasn't my focus so much, but it just happened to be that my research, anyway, that didn't really come up at all. It was much more about almost making fur look like feathers, really, making sure that they kind of move and bounce and feel really lightweight and really kind of, you know, there's a feeling of drama and sort of highlighting movement in the body very much. And then I think reptile skins, it was a lot about texture and tactility and color. And in fact, one designer said to me, you know, snake skin doesn't actually necessarily mean skin from a snake anymore. So the vocabulary for snakeskin, it means, in their eyes, means initially more of a print. You know, if you say snakeskin, it's like, oh, the print or the look of snakeskin. It's like, oh, well, it's not necessarily actually the skin from a snake. So there's also this real disconnect. So although there's although there's a connection to nature, which they find appealing, there's also a disconnect with what it really is. So that was also quite funny. So there were a lot of real kind of, a lot of things that didn't kind of, the sort of paradoxes, I suppose.
Wow, it's so fascinating.
Really, well, I mean, my focus of the research was to find out what the appeals were. And so in a sense, it was quite a positive conversation. And I didn't, my research wasn't at all about kind of casting blame or judgment in any way, but it was meant to be a very positive conversation and almost a very practical conversation, really, in terms of, what's so great about fern exotics? And then how can we learn from that? How can we apply these great things to develop alternatives? And how can we have a kind of an understanding, really, of those people who are using fern exotics as well?
I think that's such an interesting approach that you took to research, because I guess we're living in this society where we're pointing fingers and everyone's right, and we're separating and segregating ourselves from one another even more, as opposed to actually moving beyond all the so-called truths and perspectives. Okay, well, there's multiple truths, but how do we understand each other? How can we, instead of vilifying one another, perhaps we don't agree with each other's perspectives, how can we start to understand each other and create different alternatives, but together? Did anything unexpected come up through using such an approach? How was that for you? Because I'm sure it wouldn't have been easy.
I think it felt like an unusual approach, I think, because I don't use or wear animal materials. I don't eat animal products. I suppose in some senses I could have gone in with a very different mindset to it. I think because I'm a designer and because I can see that people are using these materials also because they are beautiful and they are aesthetically appealing and they've got great feel and look, and I can see that, I suppose. And so that I tried to keep that headspace, I had tried to keep that mindset when I went in. I just found it really fascinating, I suppose. I'm so interested in people who are different to me and maybe have different ideas. It was really almost about kind of trying to find common ground with people and trying to find understanding and trying to build bridges and not. It's such an emotive subject. As soon as you say fur, that you're looking into fur and animal materials, it's, people are polarized often and feel very emotional about it one way or another. And, it's very much about ethics, which it is for me. But I think this, the way I wanted to approach this was different. I started the research in 2015 and really there wasn't much reading about this subject, for example, available. And the reading that I found was, that journalists and people had tried to speak to the industry and they had just, declined requests to talk about the ethics of fern exotics. At the time when lots of PETA and everyone was protesting against the use of fern exotics, an industry just kind of clammed up. And I thought, well, yeah, it's like you say, it's about trying to bring people together actually, and not trying to polarize them even more. And surely that if we can understand why people are using these materials and what the appeals are, the appeals of being something like connection to nature or craftsmanship, or I can understand those appeals, and I think a lot of people can understand appeals and design values like that. It's just that some people decide to use certain materials to achieve those goals and other people will want to use other materials. So really it was just trying to open up a conversation really with industry to try and get them, I suppose, to reflect upon the work they were doing, for them themselves to understand a bit more deeply why they were using those materials. So I think that was interesting, definitely. I think the people I spoke to, as the conversations developed, they were able to actually reflect, understand themselves. I think sometimes they were surprised with kind of what they came out with when they really thought about it, what it was that was really drawing them to using fern exotics. So that was that was really cool. And I think, like I say, I had some really, really nice conversations. None of these people were sort of baddies, if you like. All these people are just human as well, and they have, come from different backgrounds and have different perspectives. And if we can all be driving towards the same goals, if we can all agree that Burn Exotics do have some great appeals, but they could be maybe achieved by other means, if we can all get on this or that same page and can all be driving towards similar goals. And I think they were all really open to it. You know, they were open to the idea of trying to achieve some of those design values through other means, which was great as well. So when I spoke to them, they all understood where I was coming from, and what they understood that the research was about developing alternatives. And they said, well, if you can come up with something that kind of ticks these boxes, then great. The point of the research wasn't at all to come up with something that was going to be a replica of Burn Exotics. Far from it. It was much more about delving into those deeper social and cultural appeals. And they all were kind of on board really with that idea of, well, if there is something that can also, you know, chime with some of those deeper appeals, then they would be willing to try them and experiment with them and explore. It was just the whole experience was really interesting, and just, you know, really, really nice conversations I had with people. And I learned loads. I learned so much from it myself. I really did. You know, like I say, just trying to just getting rid of that kind of goodies and baddies thing. I'm just trying to have an open and honest conversation. And I think, you know, I got the impression with a couple of people I spoke to that they'd been interviewed by people before, but no one had really dared ask them why, you know, to say something positive. So I remember speaking to one person who initially was quite defensive and quite, you know, was giving, sort of reeling off a load of facts about why fur was sustainable, but that really wasn't the point of the conversation, you know. And I had to kind of say, no, just tell me why they're so great. You know, why personally do you think that these animal materials are great, and fur, you know, what is it for you? And I think almost like a sense, there's like a sigh of relief in them that they had this space, because I don't think, I got the impression some of the time that there wasn't that space for them almost to admit what the positives for them were. And then having that chance then to think about my own practice and then trying to apply some of those appeals, which having not used Burn Exotics, I wouldn't know exactly what the appeals were myself. I wouldn't know exactly what alternatives needed to be. I did really need to talk to people who used them and loved them to really understand that. For me, it was almost a new kind of design brief, which was really cool. So I did a workshop in the Victoria and Albert Museum in the archive, and I brought out artifacts, as well as designers also brought some of their own work into the museum to discuss. We laid out all of these things on a table, and I picked things out of the archive that were from kind of late 19th century, early 20th century. So that sort of Victorian era where there's a real boom in the use of fur and exotics. And we had a round table effectively of designers who were just able to touch and feel and discuss the appeals. And it was really interesting because a couple of the designers who came in, you know, and this is all people that I pinpointed as using fur exotics, a couple of them admitted that they were vegan, which I found so bizarre.
Interesting.
So what was also interesting thing that also came out of the research was that some of the designers who were using fur exotics actually weren't that happy about using fur exotics, and were manipulating them a lot to get away from any kind of animally kind of connotations, if you like. That was quite interesting. And also obviously then facilitated the conversation between designers, but that you could see for them they were as interested in each other as they were in, you know, each other's, you know, what they each other found appealing, what each other's kind of work, you know, what kind of things they're working on, and the different ways they're manipulating materials. So that was quite interesting to kind of almost initially facilitate that, but then also stand back and just watch how those people engage with each other and what conversations came out of that. That was also really, really nice, really interesting.
Beautiful. I'm very intrigued. You were touching on before you had access to some of the archives at the V&A in London. Could you share, as part of your research, could you share a little bit about what else you discovered when you were researching through the archives?
Yeah, of course. I was really fortunate enough to get a PhD scholarship, which was through the V&A and LCF. So that immediately opened a bit of a door for me into the V&A archives and placed me with an amazing curator there who also guided me through some of their stores. And I was like an amazing point of reference herself into the appeals of fur and exotics in the Victorian era, which is the time in history I decided to partly focus on. So I looked at all sorts of clothing in their archive that had these amazing sort of, you know, fur trims and feather accents and things that have been made out of reptile skins and all sorts, also beetle wings, all sorts of materials. Wow. I suppose really all sorts of materials which are not used today. So that was interesting. It kind of, a lot of the materials that were used in the late 19th century link back to trade, and sort of world discovery of new animal species in the West anyway. Mm. And then how those, some of these new discoveries could then be portrayed through fashion. So certain people were able to get hold of these fashions, which I suppose presented animals that had just, you know, been newly discovered, like hummingbirds, for example, in South America, and beetle wing cases, and monkey skin and monkey fur. I mean, some of it obviously a little bit shocking, but also fascinating that these materials are being used decoratively to express almost a sort of worldly knowledge. So I could see that was an appeal. This kind of, you know, again, the sort of connection to nature and rarity as well. And I was interested to know how some of those appeals could be applied today. You know, how can we represent worldly knowledge or rarity in connection to nature? You know, what are these rare animal species now? And I think that's one of the reasons why contemporary designers are manipulating furs and exotics so much. I kind of linked that back a little bit to the historic era, where, you know, these animal materials genuinely were brand new and really interesting and unusual. And as I said, you know, lots of those materials have since been banned. Some of the most popular materials being used now are mink and python skin and ostrich feathers. But they're also quite commonly used. You know, ostrich feathers, for example, you can find, you know, kind of online high street retailers are using ostrich feathers as embellishment as well. So they still have this feeling of rarity. And how can the conversation be put forward into the future? Well, how do we connect with rare discoveries, maybe, or unusual histories around the world through more alternative means and, you know, things that are more caring and essentially sustainable, ethical, you could argue. And also I used the archive as well to explore some of the alternatives that people have been experimenting with during the Victorian era. One of those was spun glass that was developed in the late 19th century as an alternative to feathers. So there were also examples even then, you know, of people developing alternatives, you know, examples in the archive of pineapple fibre and banana fibre and all these kind of things that are being experimented with today all have these historic stories to them, which is really interesting. But spun glass was something that was developed initially as an alternative to feathers. So I kind of re-looked at that history, and I just wanted to find out if I could source glass today. And I found a company in the UK that was manufacturing glass yarn, so I managed to get hold of some of that and started experimenting with it, and it did have this really feathery appeal. It was really unusual material. It's really soft and ethereal, and I think what's really interesting about it is that people never know it's glass to look at it or touch it. You can't tell. It's almost like greasy hair has been like the main kind of thing that people have said when they've seen it or touched it. So I ended up experimenting a bit with glass yarn, but I originally found out about it through the archive. It's just an amazing thing to be able to look at, you know, these amazing things they have in their collections. And as well, you know, a lot of these things, they aren't on display to the public, and the museum, you know, partly feels like they're not able to display them to the public either, because they are a bit you know, these just materials that aren't used today, and I think the context maybe to displaying some of those things today might get lost, or they're in a condition which means they can't be displayed, or for whatever reasons, a lot of things I looked at were things that had never been on public display. Wow. So really fascinating. And the curator that I was working with then developed the Fashion from Nature exhibition. So that was a great, that was really, really great, and then tied into my research a little bit as well. And I'm sure if, you know, you've been to that exhibition, I'm sure a lot of people have been to that exhibition. It's such a great exhibition that they, you know, you'll remember the people wing embellishments on dresses and, you know, animal materials, and also that really great case that had some alternatives as well. So, yeah, just really, really, really cool to be part of that, to be partly part of that journey as well.
That was a beautiful exhibition, and your beautiful dress was featured in it too. Yeah. Was that with the spun glass? The dress that was featured?
Yes. So I had I had a dress. So a dress that I developed through my PhD was displayed at the exhibition in the contemporary section. And it was a dress which was made out of Ahimsa silk, organza as a base, and then it had wild rubber and glass yarn embellishments, and feathery embellishments. So I think there was some comparison to feathers, but the intention wasn't to replicate feathers as such, but they had the sort of some I was exploring really connections to some of the, you know, deeper appeals that I've talked about a bit with fur and exotics. So yeah, it was just, yeah, the whole thing was, you know, really, really amazing, really fantastic also to be part of that kind of platform with other designers who are exploring really interesting ethical and sustainable alternatives as well.
And how else do you think that designers can really integrate those values of handcraft, of rarity, of connection to nature without using animal derived materials?
I think that one thing is that what it opens up is creativity, a lot of it. Really, for me, it was so since my PhD, you know, I've noticed that a lot of designers feel that sustainability agendas can be limiting, or that's how they feel creatively. And I think that actually just saying to them, well, you know, there's these really great appeals which tie into sustainability, which can be explored, and it can be, you know, we can develop something better. We can develop something which, you know, gives people the opportunity to be maybe a bit more hands-on with what they're doing as well. So I suppose my work encourages people to make with their hands and explore through with their hands the material. And I know that not every designer has that space, but I think that if that can just be encouraged a little bit, then I think that we'll get a much deeper connection to not only nature, but just almost the self, really, and what people, you know, how people are exploring developing things and why they're developing collections. You know, and I suppose right now in this time right now with the virus, I think that hopefully people, you know, designers maybe being able to give themselves that space where they can explore more slowly, really think about some of the design things that they're, you know, some of the products that they're developing. So I think my thing really is about trying to slow down if possible, and trying to connect more deeply. And I think through craftsmanship, is something that's really valuable, something that we should try and maintain and hold on to. Exactly like I said, it's that tactile connection, which I think is such a human thing as well. And I think that there's other ways of connecting to nature. I think there's a really amazing sustainable materials which are coming out now, you know, which one interesting thing I think is plant materials which have natural markings that could be a really cool alternative or an exotics, just because of that connection to nature. And like I said, the natural markings and the fact that it's not something that's been kind of mass produced. I think that that's really an interesting area to also explore. And I think with a lot of all of these brand new materials that are coming out, I think it forces designers to have to think of new techniques as well, and new ways of working with them. Because, you know, if you're used to working with a certain material, you know, and then you source something else that's really different, that has different properties, you can't necessarily rely on your old manufacturing or manipulation techniques. It forces you to explore something different, and I think that space is really cool and really interesting. And so I think that I kind of encourage the play that comes with that, I suppose. I think it's just encouraging the reflection, and that there are materials out there that can connect, and there are techniques that can connect more deeply as well. And there's no right or wrong way to do it. And there's no, you know, my research didn't come out with a kind of fixed answer, if you like, but it was just more about, you know, each company and each designer can uniquely find their own way of maintaining their own values, but through other means and through, you know, it's an exciting time. It's something that could be, it's cool, really, you know, it's something definitely needs to be seen as a positive.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what you said. It's, I think, especially now, as we see like our economic and therefore fashion systems kind of crumbling. Yeah. And it's really, you know, I think there's a lot of reflection going on about, okay, well, how do we actually envision and create something differently and create these new paradigms that are about embracing slowness and connection and reciprocity and reverence for materials and processes and craftsmanship and nature and animals and insects and, you know, everyone that's part of this ecosystem. And yeah, I'd love to know your thoughts on what do you think's going to happen with our industry now, or and even what would you like to see happen? What would you like to envision? You know, it's a big question.
Yeah, it's a big question, isn't it? Yeah, there's so many things to consider. I think, yeah, I just really hope that there can be a slowing down. I almost think that that's the first step, is to not be producing so many collections almost mindlessly. You know, I think that it's just a slowing down is required, and looking at what we've already got as well. You know, I think I suppose fashion in its very nature is quite future focused and you know, looking to the next thing, but so many times people are drawing upon history anyway, that I think that we can just look at what we already have, you know, very much. I think with animal materials as well, it's about a larger care for the environment, really. I think that very much encompasses it. You know, when I started my research a year into starting my research, a lot of brands have started to ban fur in their collections, which time-wise was, you know, really interesting for me, because I felt like I was researching this while this journey was going on in industry, with lots of brands banning fur because of really mainly pressure from animal rights activists, and I think also a deeper awareness and connection to the environment and sustainability. And I know that a lot of people in the luxury space have also predicted that the animal materials will be phased out by 2050. So I think that's, you know, if we don't use animal materials, then what do we use instead? And is there something, you know, whatever, I think we also need to be very careful that whatever we replace it with is very mindful and very, you know, doesn't damage and hangs on to some of, like I say, some of these amazing appeals that fur and exotics do have. I mean, one of the things that also kept coming up with fur was that people were saying that, you know, people really treasure garments that have fur in them, and they'll be repaired and they'll be maintained and they'll be passed down through generations. And, you know, these are amazing appeals that we could apply to other things, not only alternatives to fur and exotics, but all aspects of alternative fashion. I was at a conference and I heard someone ask, what if we treated cotton clothes with the same level of respect as we treat fur clothes, you know? And that's really stuck with me, and I think it's so cool. And I think that's exactly almost the point of the research, is that people forget that there are some amazing appeals associated with animal materials, and that, you know, if we can apply those to other things as well, it's just a bit, it's about care and longevity, and I hope that the future of fashion embraces that a lot more, because I think it's not just about the material, it's also about people, you know, the people working in fashion. You know, this research also is about, you know, with my working with industry and giving the people I interviewed that space to reflect upon the work that they were doing. You know, I think we need more so more of that space where designers can actually think a bit more deeply about what it is they want to put out into the world, and also designing things for longevity and designing things that can be renewed and designing things that can be repaired, and that just have maybe some just a level of deeper care, really, and value.
Yeah, and our current systems just completely don't allow for those things.
I think, you know, as well, it's also probably what put me off going into fashion in this, you know, in a typical way. You know, when I first graduated from my degree, I just, you know, I'd done a lot of internships, and some of them had been good, but some of them had just been, you know, these crazy kind of 20-hour days, you know, and everyone just burnt out, you know, which I'm sure you know.
Yeah,
well,
I can relate to that.
And I just thought, oh, you know, yeah, it doesn't seem like an appealing environment at all. And not, to be honest, not even really a very appealing environment for a creative person, actually. So I think it's a bit of, you know, what I'm trying to do was almost not as much as it being a call to look at alternatives to animal materials. It's also a call for creativity, actually, and the slowing down. Yeah, so much, because that can't sustain itself, you know, and every aspect of the idea of sustainability, a lot of what we're doing is unsustainable, really. I think, if you know, think of the word of sustainability as something that, you know, something that we can keep going with, and something that, you know, the idea of something, you know, what can be sustained. Well, I think that the way that we're working in fashion right now definitely can't be sustained, and it shouldn't be sustained.
No,
you know, not only for the designers, but for everyone on the supply chain, and for the planet, and it's, you know, everyone's being exhausted.
Yeah, it seems like quite an exciting time we're living in at the moment, despite all the craziness, and absolutely not disregarding all the suffering that's happening at the moment. But I think it is, Naomi and I have spoken about this a little bit, but just it's allowing for a bit of a reset and reflection into what is it that we want, and exactly, what is it that we want to contribute to.
Really is. I know, it's just, you know, what is it that we want to take from this? What is it from our status quo that we want to maintain, and what is it that we want to change? It's definitely a big question, I think, right now. And yeah, all we can do is just hope really that this time away effectively gives people that chance to want to connect more deeply, want to be more mindful.
I hope so too. And I also wanted to ask you, jumping back into your research, you completed a artist residency in the Amazon as part of your research, which sounded and looked absolutely amazing. And you were recording rare insect species through your textile embellishments, from what I've read. Could you take us a bit through this time you had in the Amazon and how this actually contributed to your research and your practice, because you were actually engaging with nature and creating with nature?
It was, it's absolutely amazing. I went out to the Amazon rainforest in Brazil to undertake a residency with LabVerd, which is effectively an immersion program which takes artists and designers out to the Amazon to reflect on nature, and also to reflect a little bit on science as well, the science that links with nature. So my proposal originally was to explore if there could be an alternative way that scientists could record, well, not scientists, but just an alternative way of recording newly found exotic species in the Amazon, rather than taking a euthanized specimen, which is what scientists currently do. So they have to take a live animal out when they first discover a new species. I was just interested in finding out whether there was an alternative way of recording nature, and, as I say, an alternative way of recording newly discovered species, because there's aspects that are lost through that method of recording. And then I was interested to see whether textiles, with its ideas of kind of movement, which is kind of lost in the physical samples that we have. So that was the original kind of idea, and I felt like it linked nicely to my PhD research as well, which overall was looking at alternatives to animal materials. And I went out into the rainforest originally thinking I'd see all these like amazing mammals and huge birds and reptiles and things like that, which you can sometimes, but really everything's hiding, you know. It's not the sort of like it's not a zoo experience by any means at all. So in fact, what I ended up seeing a lot more of was amazing insects, which I wasn't prepared for, and I didn't really think about so much, but I saw really cool and crazy insects. And I went out one night on a night walk and just happened to shine my torch to the right of me, and saw this crazy insect, which I later found out was a leaf hopper nymph, this tiny little insect which was sort of hopping around and had these, it's almost like a tail, it's long, these fronds that were coming out like a tail, and they were sort of iridescent. And just really, I'd never seen anything like it, and I just thought that these species are so hard to record through other means. You know, you can take a photograph of them, or you can attempt to take a specimen from the forest. But what was interesting about that insect and some other insects that I found was the movement as well. And so I tried to find out if I could try and record that through embellishment, which obviously, you know, with insects, sort of like small components anyway, so it kind of worked really well. But I developed a series of samples which recorded two different types of leaf fans, a caterpillar, which is quite rare. And I found out that leafhopper nymph that I'd shone my torch on was fairly newly discovered species as well, only been discovered a few years ago. So that was really exciting. And also the fronds that came out of it. So it's effectively a waxy substance that is coming out of this insect. And it looked really similar to the glass yarn that I've been working with anyway. So it had this kind of weird sort of iridescent sort of, you know, looks really soft. So that played really well. I was experimenting with that. But then also it, you know, the other insects, which was just so unusual to look at, that it forced me then to source materials that I wouldn't initially have sourced, which is also quite interesting for me. So I was playing around with banana fiber. I found some banana fiber which looked a little bit like this insect. And there was one insect that hopped around a lot, especially in groups. They kind of if you go near them, so basically they produce these waxy fronds. The idea is that if a predator tries to eat them, these waxy fronds break off and they jump away, because they're kind of defense mechanism, if you like. And so you get them in group. When they're in groups, there's these really cool videos on YouTube of these leaf, you should Google it, leafhopper nymphs kind of jumping around. And I was like, this is really, really creative for me to think, well, how can I try and represent that through textiles? The idea was that I would develop these sort of artifacts, if you like, that I could then take away, and then the people that would then see them and interact with them could understand a little bit more about those insects that I'd seen in the forest. So it was almost a method of communication, really, of these things that I'd seen and discovered. And I played around with magnets. So those embellishments in particular, I was sewing magnets into each embellishment so that when they're lying flat, you don't see it so much. But as soon as you start handling the textile samples, these little magnets start pushing and pulling away from each other. So you effectively get the sample that kind of moves in your hands with you. And also I was thinking of ways of trying to represent rarity of some of these insects. So I purposely didn't create very many embellishments. So it was also to try and represent this idea of rarity. Or I looked at sort of hidden embellishments as well as ways of trying to communicate some of those values. So I suppose that, you know, that also could be something that could be explored much more deeply, is how do we represent ideas of rarity in fashion? But yeah, they were really sort of, I suppose, yeah, I mean, that time is just amazing to be immersed in the forest and to just have that chance. It's 10 days and we went on hikes and everything, and we had the chance to also just draw and make and absorb it all and write and really reflect. And I suppose it made me, you know, the thing I've touched on a little bit, you know, about looking at history as well, looking at the 19th century and how a lot of rare animal materials were being represented in fashion. This trip to the Amazon gave me that experience of actually engaging with rare animals myself, and then thinking, well, how can I, obviously, instead of taking some of those animals from the forest and making some embellishment out of the real thing, you know, how can I represent what I've experienced through embellishment, through other means? I suppose I was almost forcing myself to experience that journey myself, actually, as a designer, in terms of how I do, you know, from physically seeing the animal to then trying to represent the animal in some means, and then considering how that could be represented in the best way through textiles, and, you know, with the feeling of movement that you get with textiles, which was a really cool thing to experiment with.
It's almost like taking it to another level, as opposed to so much in design. You know, we're just looking at something visually, at the aesthetic for inspiration, whilst you were actually trying to connect with that experience of being there in that moment, and then interpreting that into however that may look whilst connecting with the material.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, exactly. So some of that work was then exhibited, and I was encouraging people to touch and interact and use that as a method of of trying to understand, yeah, as you say, I guess my experience a little bit more.
Which I think we need so much more of in design, as opposed to just taking these ideas from places, as opposed to actually reflecting, as you mentioned, on things and then interpreting them like based on how we've experienced them in a personal, very personal way.
Yes, I think so. I think that a lot of fashion looks at aesthetic replica, or just at least aesthetic inspiration. And I mean, I can't say that that's always the case. Of course, it isn't. You know, there's lots of other conceptual work going on. But I think that plays its part in this idea of slowing down so much, I think, and really considering something on a much deeper level. And, you know, my research with Foreign Exotics was never, the intention was never to kind of go in and try and find something that would be basically like a faux fur. You know, it was never the intention I had. It was much more about opening up a conversation and delving a lot deeper into the appeals. I think it's also meant that it's a conversation that can continue. You know, I feel like my research it's almost been quite hard to finish it. You know, it's something that can, it's a conversation and a topic that could continue so much and could be, as I said, you know, applied to so many other things as well. You know, it just happened to be my interest was with animal materials, but it could be explored with all sorts of, you know, a method effectively to explore other things in fashion as well. You know, other types of materials, but maybe, you know, other elements as well, not just the material.
Absolutely. And yeah, where do you see this research and your work going now? Where would you like it to go?
I think ideally really is that it's that I can keep, what I'd like to do is to almost really keep working in the way I was working on my PhD, which I found just seemed to fit me well, but also seemed to come to sort of bring out lots of interesting work, and also it made me interact with other designers. So I think what I'd like to be doing really now is to keep having those conversations, you know, keep going into industry and doing, you know, maybe an interview, maybe is more, looks maybe more like a sort of consultancy now, or a workshop, talks, but we're very much with them playing a part in it too, you know, not going in and, you know, not a preachy thing, but going in and just opening up these conversations. I think I'd still really like to continue doing that. I'd still like to be continuing to make work. A lot of what the work I've done so far is not finished products, but very much just like early stage ideas and conversation points. So I think there could potentially be space for those, some of that to be realized more practically. So that's something I'm considering, is that whether some of this stuff could be, you know, really developed and really tested and made into garments that some people could wear with this embellishment on them. So I think that's also an avenue I'd like to go down. As a designer, it's not just about manufacturing clothes that people can wear. It's also about, you know, I found this working with the museum, it's also about developing work that the public can comment on and reflect upon and can open up discussions. So I'm currently kind of trying to explore how that fits a little bit at the moment, how the role of a designer should be really now. You know, I don't think with the work I've been doing, I don't think it's ever going to be mass produced. And that was never really the intention, but maybe there could be something where I could produce a few things on a small scale, or also just considering to research and come up with new ideas and experiments that just opens up conversations. And then it's really up to the brands then to take that on themselves, you know, if they want to develop it further and they develop it in their own way as well. So I suppose that's, yeah, ideally that's where I see the future for myself and for this work being, really, is that kind of space.
Yeah, your work is so much part of this new paradigm that I'm hoping we're going to slowly start tipping into more and more. So I look forward to seeing how your work emerges and what you create.
Oh, thank you.
Is there anything else that you would like to add before we close off our conversation today?
The one kind of thing that I've mainly been thinking about through doing some of this work is that, you know, the appeals I found with Foreign Exotics can be applied to so many other design developments. It's not only alternatives to animal materials. I think it's about pinpointing what appeals and design values we want to maintain. I've been so frustrated myself with, people working in sustainability, or people having discussions around sustainability, and animal ethics and the treatment of animals just never comes into it. And I find that so weird. And I've also heard, what about, you know, the treatment of animals? in farms, or you know, that should be a part. And it's like, oh well, no, that's a sort of another subject. It's sort of off, and it's just, well, what subject is that then? You know, like, what, how would you? It's not. It should be part of. It's a, I don't know. It's just that it needs to be more holistic, doesn't it, than that? You know, it needs to be more encompassing. And it's just really, I think the problem is that a lot of people think that there's still very much the sort of like natural materials are great, synthetic materials are terrible, very, very black and white. And I think people think animal materials, natural materials, they're great, they're sustainable. You can't argue with that. And I found that a little bit with my research, a little, you know, myself, you know, a lot of, you know, like I said, when, one of the people I spoke to was a little bit defensive at first, and they just immediately were like, well, I'll first sustainable because it's a natural material and that's it. Like that's the, you know, I had to be like, okay, you know, I'm not even going to get into that. Like, it's not my place for this interview to get into whether first sustainable or not in that, from that point of view. But, you know, actually, you know, and it's hard actually to move her away from that subject, and to, people just, I think a lot of people just see it very black and white, see it very like animal materials or natural materials, and they forget that the amount of chemicals that have been applied to fur to prevent them from rotting mean that they're not biodegradable anyway. You know, that was a really weird thing when I was at Burberry, when people were saying that, you know, they wanted a material that was biodegradable. It's like, well, is biodegradability the only answer for end of life, for a start? And secondly, lots of animal materials aren't biodegradable anymore. And I don't know, it's just, it's weird how there's, I suppose it's there's that's just the focus, and it's not thinking about the whole production of that animal material. And like I say, you know, leathers and leather tanning, and you know, the same stuff will be going on with alligator skin and snake skin as well. I think that, yeah, I've had lots of conversations with people who, some people think fur is sustainable, some people think it isn't. And there's a really good report by Delft, I think it's Delft, that came out, which is the fur, what's it called, Sustainability of Fur Report or something. And that's really interesting, because that measures fur, I think, using 18 different points. So it looks at all sorts of things. So like the water, the amount of water that's used, the amount of chemicals that are used, the supply chain, the treatment of, you know, the pay, the treatment of people, that it compares fake fur to natural fur, and all sorts of different points that could be considered sustainable. And that fake fur actually comes out as being, by the end of the report, they're saying fake, if anything, fake fur is more sustainable than natural fur, which is interesting. So I kind of, that's something that's been used, that report was really good and really, really thorough. And that's something that I, whenever I get into a conversation with someone that will like refuse to accept that fur is not very sustainable, I always kind of refer back to that. But still, it's not ideal. It's obviously not, you know, fake fur isn't obviously great. So it's my thing really was saying that, you know, natural fur is not good, fake fur is not good. What else is there? You know, what else can we be exploring, and how could we be exploring?
Do you ever think about like the trauma that must be kept in the fur from the animals?
That's why I loved your last podcast episode, because it really, I was like, yes, you know, like that's so, something I've thought about, and you just articulated it so well. I think it's so cool, and it's so true. I think it's so true, and I think it's the only people I know that are, you know, the Himsa silk, which I mentioned, is something that comes from, I think, Jainism, you know, like a sect of Buddhism in India, that people are looking at these. I think Ahimsa means no harm, so they look at that. I think they're very much interested in this idea that materials hold energy and karma, and I think that's very, very, very true. I think that's also, people are starting to see that, or at least talk about that in meat, aren't they? In food, and saying that, you know, well, this piece of beef, you know, has been, you know, this animal's been treated so badly, it's got certain, whatever you want to call it, really, energy or a certain, some, I think even there might even be some science in it, really, you know, some say that people eating this, I think there has, you know, I'm thinking about it, I feel like there has been some research which has shown that depression in people is linked to people eating meat of animals who are depressed effectively. I feel like I've seen that somewhere else. Anyway, but yeah, I think that's just so true, and it's definitely a conversation that's starting with meat and animal products. And I think, weirdly, fashion's almost a little a step behind that conversation with animal materials. Yeah, I think and not just animal materials, but yeah, other types of materials. If people have been, you know, the person who's made that material, if they've been treated badly, or it's so physical, it's still, textiles is still such a physical manufacturing, the hands-on really manufacturing process. You know, it's still, you know, someone's making that thing, and what are they putting into that thing that's being made, and what energy are they putting into that? Is such a huge point that hasn't really been addressed.
No, not at all. Yeah. Kind of wild.
It's really funny. When I was in Singapore, there's not very many charity shops in Singapore, and the idea of secondhand is kind of a little bit out there for them, because in apparently Chinese, I've probably told you this already actually, but yeah, Chinese culture, they don't like the idea of wearing secondhand clothing, because they believe that spirit of the person who's died will be in that clothing, and it's a negative, seen as a negative thing. It's like, oh, I don't want to wear that, because I don't want the spirit of the deceased occupant of that item of clothing to be part, you know. So obviously there's something there, some people, or there's some understanding of energy being transfused into textiles. So you know, why not think of it with new clothing and the people who've actually physically made that thing, which, if anything, is going to be holding the energy even more. I think it's so cool, you know. I think that should just be blown out into such a huge topic. Yeah,
definitely. I agree. Thank you so much for sharing so kindly with us all today. I've learnt so much and so inspired by the work that you're doing, and I wish for us to continue many more conversations into the future, Naomi.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been so cool to be part of this conversation with you, and yeah, and hopefully, you know, this work links to your podcast and the topics you're exploring, and you know, it's all about looking at the whole issue of sustainability, the whole topic of sustainability much more deeply, isn't it, really, and more holistically.
Exactly.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this week's conversation.
For today's show notes, to get in touch or sign up to our mailing list, you can find links at the bottom of this episode page.
And if you are new to our community, then head on over to our Instagram at sustainability5.0 and our website www.sustainability5.world. And follow along to stay up to date with our upcoming online and in-person events.
If you found value in today's conversation, then we would so appreciate it if you would subscribe and leave us a review. Through this, you're helping others to find these important conversations.
Have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.